So I've been wanting to talk to you and actually other members of the In Her Time Coalition for a while, right? And everything going on, I'd never really quite got the chance to pull it together. I was really hoping to do a Zoom thing with all the candidates way back. I wasn't good at Zoom. I didn't even have Zoom, so I wasn't even sure how to use it. And so it's taken me a while, and I apologize for doing it this way, but you're successfully in now.
I'm in.
And you're in. And so I want to like start a little bit in the back because I don't know you well. I don't know that a lot of people who are going to watch this know you well yet, right?
No, Pawtucket doesn't know me well. I'll be honest. I'll go to events and introduce myself, and people are, like, oh, you're Alexis? Like, I didn't.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, that's it. That's just it. So this will be a chance to like talk a little bit about it. So what I wanted to start with is your interest in politics. If you're interested in running, I know you worked on social justice issues before running. So if you want to talk a little bit about your background, where you came from and what your ideas were that got you motivated to run in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am not a native Rhode Islander. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in a college town. My father was an economics professor at the time. So I was born in Durham when he was teaching at Duke. He moved to Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, and that's where I grew up, basically. I had a lot of amazing opportunities through the public education system of North Carolina to, I guess, explore interests, even at a very young age. In high school, I got the chance to go to the Youth in Government program of North Carolina, which allowed high schoolers to basically create a mock Congress and work on legislation and debate. And as a freshman there, I introduced a civil unions type of law, and this was in the early 2000s, I suppose.
When only Massachusetts had marriage.
Exactly. Around the same time, I've always been, I came out as queer, like pretty young in high school. I was also very openly Jewish in a Baptist type of a Baptist town. I stood out quite a bit in that time period. And my father was always, progressive. He loved like campaign season. My whole family, my mother too, like we talked about politics. It wasn't something that we shied away from at the table. And we've always had a progressive values as a family. And when I came up to Boston for school, I spent 3 years. I graduated from Emerson, bounced around Boston for about 10, with all sorts of jobs. And then settled here in Rhode Island and felt like, oh my gosh, this feels like home. And I don't quite know why, but especially moving to Pawtucket, there are a lot of similarities between like how I feel living in Pawtucket and how I felt living in Winston-Salem. And thinking about the skills that I had acquired just throughout my career and my interests, I had always had the dream of running for an office, and local office especially, where things really get done and we solve big problems with little budgets. Like that is my bread and butter. I worked in the tech field in Boston for years, and you're usually not given a ton of resources to solve very big challenges. So trying to get things done fast, trying to work with teams of people that have varied interests and experiences. Like that's where I love to sit right in the middle of that. And being in a position like a city councilor, I felt just well suited and gave it a shot, and it turned out pretty well.
It was an interesting election or campaign you ran because if we looked at like first day returns, you were not winning.
No.
And in fact, I think I wasn't alone, and a lot of people just thought, oh, well, that's not used to the new reality of COVID. A lot of people were just saying, wow, that was, she lost by what, like 200 votes or something you were trailing. And you picked them all up on mail ballots. How did that work?
Yeah, no, that's I'll be frank, I was just as surprised. I knew I had a feeling it was going to be close. Kind of having my ear to the like the pulse of what's going on in Pawtucket, and starting to get to know everyone and knowing like what their voting style was going to be, I had a feeling there would be a significant amount of mail ballots, but I had no idea what way they would go. So that limbo period of like, oh, I'm down, you know, 50, 100, whatever, and then the flip a couple days later, I had that same feeling of like a little bit of a mouth drop, being like, oh, okay, here we go. Like, let's wait for certification. Let's double check everything. It was, I mean, I'm sure many municipalities and state governments like were doing new routines to manage the amount of mail ballots, emergency ballots, etc. I thought the state of Rhode Island did a tremendous job at making sure folks got registered, had the ability to receive mail ballots. I do want to personally thank the Secretary of State for the work done there. And it in Pawtucket, as with many towns, you know, we've tried really hard to keep people safe during an unprecedented health crisis. And so my hope was that mail ballots would be big. I didn't realize they would be big for me personally, but I'm grateful.
Yeah. And you beat a 30-year incumbent, which is amazing, because I'm not sure. I don't think you're 30. Or are you 30?
I am 34.
34. Okay, so.
I'm 34. I dress like a high schooler, which
okay.
I got called out quite a bit when I was canvassing around. And I was like, yeah, I'm a comfort type person. You'll probably always see me walk around the neighborhood in like a flannel and a t-shirt.
Right.
This is what I also like wore to work usually when I was working at tech companies in Boston. It's, you know, exactly. It's hoodie culture.
Right.
And it's, but it was great to see that, you know, the city of Pawtucket is really engaged politically, which I find to be spectacular. I love having an engaged community of folks to speak with, to derive ideas from. And with this campaign in particular, I had to try to be flexible. I tried to stay off the doors as much as I could for safety reasons. I tried to engage folks digitally, one-on-one, in groups. And having worked in the tech field for almost a decade, doing video conferencing, having to work with folks from all over the world to get projects accomplished, I had that leg up going into an election that had to be focused in a very different way than normally a city council type of election is won.
Right. So how did you hook up with the It's Her Time Coalition? Because every one of those people I liked, and I've been a fan of their work for many, many years. And so I followed them on and off, and I've written about almost everybody there, except maybe you. I think you might be the one person I hadn't written about previous to that. So how did you hook up with them?
Yeah, I had, prior to officially announcing the campaign, when I was thinking about running again, I had really admired a lot of the progressives that had run 2 years prior. One of those folks was Janie Siggy Rodriguez. And I really wanted to just get to know her personally, because we live in different neighborhoods and we're both, I know she's super busy, I'm super busy. So we went and had a meal pre-COVID and talked about things that we were interested in, education, the economy. We talked about crypto actually quite a bit, and sort of the new economy. And I thought, you know, wow, like I knew she was amazing. I didn't realize we had so much in common. And then when she and Stephanie Olarte and Aji Gaika, like when everyone started to like really think about putting their hat in the ring, I just felt privileged to be part of that group and to be kind of accepted into it, because again, an incredibly strong slate. Every one of the women involved could and would be an amazing city councilor. I think just in my ward, there was just an appetite for someone new and someone who had the particular type of skill sets that I could bring to the table. But I mean, it was a stacked group of people that I think would serve well in any type of governance.
And they'll be back in a couple of years, I'm sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. And folks are still involved. You know, you have Tarshir Battle, who's still a city liaison and working with the Taft Community Garden. Aji is busy working at schools and working to help folks get into college. And we're all still here. We're all still working hard, and nothing's really changing about that.
Cool. All right. So now you're on the city council. And I think you've had two or three meetings so far.
Yep, technically three. The first one was just the inauguration and sort of ceremonies meeting. But yes, we've had two council meetings up to this point.
Right. And so, and one of the things you did almost like right away, and I thought this was pretty interesting, was, and this is actually one of the reasons I thought I really need to reach out. You worked with the council president to, for gender neutral terminology for the council. And I thought that was really neat. Can you talk a little bit about that? What those discussions were like, where the ideas came from, and how you managed to do that?
Yeah. I, again, you know, not really, not being someone who's from Pawtucket and not really knowing many of these folks personally, because I couldn't get to meet them during this health crisis. I try to look at the dockets that were given in a very neutral sense and say, you know, if I'm looking at this with fresh eyes and if I could change anything that would benefit either myself or the community, I'm gonna try to take the opportunity to do that. And I also felt, you know, it was my responsibility running as an, you know, out queer progressive person. Mm-hmm. You know, I use she her pronouns, but because I kind of give off vibes that aren't traditionally feminine, I do get asked a lot, you know, what are my pronouns? And I appreciate those types of questions, but it led me to realize that when I was looking at the rules, the rule sheet, that it would potentially help folks who maybe don't fall into a gender binary spectrum if they were running in the future, or say, like me, they found themselves actually winning an election and sitting on the council, to be able to look at a rule sheet in the future and say that, oh, it actually, you know, I don't have, this already reflects me, because it doesn't actually split in that kind of binary sense that traditional, old, like things written in older language just tend to have that type of lexicon. And so I thought, you know what, I'm just going to give the council pro tem, Councilor Mercer, a call and ask his thoughts on this, because it's kind of an untraditional ask. We didn't have a lot of time to like tell people ahead of time what we were doing. But again, Pawtucket is an amazing place. It is progressive. And especially when it comes to issues that have kind of a level of sensitivity to them, like pronouns or kind of gender and presentation, I had a good feeling that it wouldn't be a controversial ask to just sort of strip that language, make it more inclusive overall. And it was like a quick, simple change that I hope will benefit someone down the line.
Very cool. I have to say that in my work over here at Uprise, I very long ago gave up using councilwoman and councilmen. And I started using councilor with an OR at the end. Mm-hmm. But then someone talked to me and they said they didn't really love that because it's too close to counselor, as in a lawyer or a person who gives counsel, you know? And so now I'm settled on council member. Mm-hmm. I was council person, but I think council member is where I'm settled right now. Mm-hmm. What are you saying in Pawtucket now when you say councilor?
Oh, I describe myself as a councilwoman.
Okay.
I personally, you know, since I use she, her pronouns, and I, you know, I think that it is what helps about these types of conversations is even opening up the conversation to what would make you feel most respected as a person, right, to like honor the title that you have and sort of the, I don't want to say status, it sounds strange, but honoring sort of the position that you have in the community. You know, having, asking someone like, would you like me to call you councilwoman, councilman, councilperson, right, counselor, some guy, like everyone in Pawtucket will give you a different answer as to what feels good, but as long as you start to get to know them, it kind of just works a little bit easier. But it is, I think it's great to kind of have that fluidity and say like, well, today council person felt good, but now it feels, one, it doesn't roll off the tongue super well.
Not a great
two,
word.
Two, it just, like, saying council anything is kind of a mumble jumble mess. But, you know, it creates great discussions like this, because then you realize like, oh, if someone does come into these roles that maybe is non-binary, uses other types of neo-pronouns, it won't be as much of a hurdle for them to feel like they are representing their community as their authentic self.
Yeah, as far as council person or goes, congressperson is even worse.
Oh gosh, yeah, it just like sounds bad.
It's really hard to get my head around it. And I've been doing this a long time, and every time I look at it, I'm like, so I've, to avoid that, I sometimes say US representative, right? I write it all out.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to say congressman and congresswoman. I really want to move away from those terms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it's a thing I think about a lot. And that's why it really struck me when I read that in the Valley Breeze, I think, that about that little paragraph. And I thought, oh, that was really interesting and a really interesting thing for a first-time legislator to step into. And I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah, and, you know, big kudos to President Moran, President Pro Tem Mercer, as well as our two amazing city clerks. Mm-hmm. They did not really get the heads up that I was going to do this because it was kind of a last-minute idea. And they, as always, just stepped up to the challenge, got the work done, and I super appreciate it.
Yeah, it seemed like it was not controversial in the least, which was even better, right?
Controversial, but it does take like the busy work of editing.
Yeah.
Not inconsequential in terms of
absolutely right. And I mean, I understand that. It's a onus on the clerks for now, but after a few years, it's just gonna be as natural as anything else. So
exactly.
Yeah, it's just a little change. That's great. All right, so I have some other questions. These get more into like general policy ideas, right? So one of the things is Pawtucket is in the news a lot for the schools being closed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the way things are set up in Pawtucket, I don't think you have any control over how the schools do their thing. It's like two very separate things. But what are your thoughts about the schools and what should be done and how, I'm sure people ask you or it's come up sometimes.
You'd be surprised. People don't, you know, because of that, excuse me, because we have kind of those co-equal councils, in a sense, people usually don't ask my opinion on the school committee because they recognize, one, I don't really, it's not my purview. We have a great school committee that is working diligently on those school issues. So I don't really get a ton of questions about it. Okay. I think they have also done tremendous work. I've watched the meetings and I've seen the conversations, and they're taking every issue, every new set of data that comes in. They're really analyzing it at a deep level. And I just, on a personal level, I just think that they are doing tremendous work. I would have a really hard time sitting on that committee right now, trying to make these decisions, because there is a ton of pressure. It is an incredibly complex issue when you talk about the needs of every student that is in these districts. And with the decision to remain closed, you know, knowing the schools in my district, and also knowing how the rates of COVID-19 have stayed high and increased in Pawtucket and Central Falls in particular, I couldn't see making another decision than what they have made personally, just to keep the community safe, because I would not sacrifice anyone's health for what I think is sort of an invisible threat of this learning loss concept. To me, is something that I don't think there's such a thing as learning loss, because I think every day is a new opportunity to learn. Like, even my valedictorian in college was an untraditional student, you know, someone in their 30s who was doing undergrad. And so I think I would rather have our kids, parents, everyone involved in education stay safe until bigger rollouts of the vaccine occur and we have more ability to get safe as a community. But yeah, they are, you know, they're doing their thing. The council is doing our work, and we communicate frequently, but we don't really try to weigh in, I guess, on each other's hard work.
Sure. So in that being the case, what are the issues that the council is working on? What do you think are the bigger issues that you want to tackle or should be tackling or are tackling?
Yeah. We have a bit of a budget issue in the city. We just had a council meeting last night where we started to talk about what has been told to us in terms of, you know, a deficit at the city government level and how we're going to manage the decisions about next year's fiscal budget for the city. And it's questions about, will there be a supplemental tax increase? You know, how will we provide the same level of services to our constituents with less money? How do we continue to pay for maybe even new positions and new, there's new costs to protecting the health of the community. So where do you kind of trim every piece of that to make sure that the right priorities stay at the top of the list? And that is, I think, going to be a very challenging set of decisions that the council is going to make alongside the administration. It is, again, two co-equal branches of government trying to find common ground, but it's going to be tough.
You think you'll get some federal help here? I mean, there should be some.
That is the hope. I think I can't speak for anything that's going on in the mayor's office because, again, it is a separate world over there. But I'm hoping that maybe with more contacts, more communication, we can try to leverage all of the possibilities to make sure that we can run successfully as a city and just stay afloat. We have a big development project coming to the city of Pawtucket, as we know.
All that stuff under the riverfront, right? All that stuff.
Exactly. That the Tidewater Landing project on the riverfront. And how do you balance and also communicate with the city about something that's going on that front that is largely a private sector event?
But there are some public aspects to it, right? There's a train going in right at the head of it, more or less. And then there's all those types of, you know, you'll be responsible for building on ramps and roads in, and you know,
exactly. It requires so much coordination to make sure that we are not sacrificing the quality of life of our community members for the sake of a revenue opportunity with the stadium and the city. I'll be frank, we also really want a team again. I'm going to say that personally, but it's been a hard year to see folks mourn the loss of a beloved team and to see, I can't even speak to any of the issues around that because I don't know what happened. But I know that people all over the state are frustrated. I know people are, you know, this year's the 40th anniversary of the longest game. And like, what a bittersweet year to celebrate that anniversary, because if the lights aren't on at McCoy, you know, and that anniversary comes up, it's like, oh, we didn't really even get a chance to say goodbye thanks to COVID.
Right. Yeah. COVID just killed that. Right. Which we would have killed it even if they were staying, even if we were going to stay in the stadium, we would still be in this position now.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to this, like, what, you know, everybody will ask this question. What about McCoy? What about that area? I saw that a restaurant near McCoy has just asked for an expansion and got an expansion permission from there. But like, what else is to be done? Because that whole area now is ripe for some sort of redevelopment, right? I mean,
yeah,
McCoy is a big hole that needs to be filled, and that means there's an opportunity there to do something.
Absolutely. And my understanding is that way, way back, you know, when the question of are they staying or are they going was occurring, both the city and the state put out RFPs and received a variety of applications as to, you know, how to deal with that land, to either redevelop it, to continue using it as a stadium. Right. There was talk of sort of a unified high school. There's all sorts of conversations. Yeah. And I, at this point, I have no idea as to how the administration is going to tackle that. I know that Governor Raimondo and Mayor Grebian were very close to the Fortuitous Partners Project as it relates to the new stadium. Yep. But, you know, I think everyone in the Pawtucket community just wants to make sure that that McCoy does not become an unattended, you know, I want it to be used in some capacity. It is a great area. I'd love to see Pawtucket baseball played in there just at least one more time if yeah. something is going to happen to that. And honestly, my personal delight would be to see like the Pawtucket Slaterettes play there. I think some, or like even having community baseball leagues from all over the state come and kind of say goodbye at some point once COVID's gone, like just to give McCoy a proper send off if it's no longer going to be a stadium. I just, it's a confusing process that I'm only just starting to learn in terms of how these plots of land get either acquired or loaned out or leased out, excuse me. And so there's a lot of ideas that came in the past. I don't know if those are going to come back to the surface or if we're going to try other things, you know, as a city to maintain the property ourselves. It's up in the air at this point.
But it is also, it's a national historical monument.
Right. Exactly.
Because a state has invested in it. There's a lot of investments there. So it's not just the city, but the state and even maybe national interest mm-hmm. in doing something with that stadium or land or something. So I don't know what that looks like, but yeah, you're mm-hmm. right. It's a tough problem, but it's going to be worked out in the next couple of years somehow, right? Over the next couple of years, you'll be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm certainly going to be involved in this new development project because that's right in the heart of my ward. So just kind of knowing how that is going and keeping folks informed. But McCoy is not in my ward, but it's right on the edge of it. So I will be, you know, in those rooms, hopefully at the table, kind of learning what's going to happen there. It's funny because growing up in North Carolina, I was a huge baseball fan. And you kind of, in North Carolina, you have to either pick the Braves or the Orioles. So I became an Orioles fan because I had family there. And my favorite player of all time was Cal Ripken Jr. or is Cal Ripken Jr. So I learned like about Pawtucket at a very young age.
Yeah, right.
And then to kind of like be here now and to kind of think about what it was like maybe back then and sort of like in the heyday, I love thinking about that. I hope we can get back to that vibe here in Pawtucket. We have some great small businesses that are planting roots here. But the stadium is kind of a beacon that right now is a little dulled out, and we got to figure out a way to bring the community together, the administration together, and our council together and the state. Like, all these people have interest in that property. So how can we actually make it work?
Yeah. Cool. All right. That's a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of interconnections there because we talk about the thing going on in your ward, mm-hmm. you know, the soccer stadium. We talk about McCoy. There's also other plots of land throughout, particularly like the Apex site and other places, right? Where we talked about developments there and around, and even the downtown Pawtucket really mm-hmm. needs a big like jump start, right? It needs a little bit of a moment, maybe, or maybe not. Maybe it needs to be smoothed over and turned into something else. I don't know what the solutions are, but
I feel like I'm in the same headspace that you are, where it's like there is no lack of great ideas for how to bring like great small businesses back to Pawtucket, to have sort of this revitalization of downtown. There's great ideas. And even now we have stores that have been there for a couple years, like Top Shelf Vintage Clothing and Circuit BMX, like stores that are doing exceptionally well, have weathered the storm of COVID-19 because they're just strong, focused small businesses in the community. And I hope also through their example of I don't want to say taking a chance on downtown Pawtucket, but like really investing back into that area of the city, it will inspire other folks to do the same thing and to begin to see these districts kind of both organically form, but also maybe get help from other places to move the pace of that redevelopment in a smart and community-focused way. We don't want to just have everyone come in and start, you know, a bidding war on these historic properties. We really want to make sure that any kind of development is taken into careful consideration, because I love how my slogan was preserving Pawtucket. I think the architecture here, I think the buildings here, I think there is so much we can do without taking a wrecking ball to these properties. It just is going to take a lot more grit and hard work and elbow grease to do that and to get these buildings into shape where, you know, like high schoolers, like the folks that went to high school in Pawtucket, started the Heel Room up here. You know, those are the types of community members we want to continue to like invest in downtown and other parts of the city to start their businesses.
And you have to make it as easy as possible for them to do so, right?
Exactly. And now, especially with City Hall, like we can't, it's the process of licensing, like these are very complex things and you have to go through a lot of steps. So we want to try to keep that momentum going, even during COVID-19, when you can't just walk into City Hall and get business done as easy as you used to.
Right. Okay. So I'll ask that same question again. So what else is there that you saw on your agenda? What else are you thinking about here as you move into it? I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of ideas, but
yeah,
what's some of the bigger stuff you see on the horizon?
In terms of promises that I made and the campaign that I ran, I would really love to see more green municipal waste management solutions. I've been personally using a composting service here, like a private composting service, for almost the whole time that I've lived here. And really, it's as simple as I have a bucket, just a little bucket. I fill it up every week. I put it on my porch just like I would for a trash can. And then they give me a new bucket and we swap it out. And keeping organic waste out of the trash system, I think one, we can actually get that compost back and use it to re-beautify areas of Pawtucket, but also it helps with a lot of the nuisances that have come into the city because, you know, if there's trash around, you have rats, you have pestilence, you have other types of, you know, things that come and then eat that organic waste. And so if we could kind of change the conversation in Pawtucket to be less about where are we going to put the next landfill or transfer station and move it towards what are the other ways we can handle waste management, that I'm hoping that over the next 2 years, I can talk about that and I can encourage either through private industry or through the city kind of starting some kind of composting movement. Like, I hope we can get that done. I think it would help on a lot of fronts, but it would most certainly help with the issues that we've had where rats are kind of coming into residential districts in droves, frankly.
Oh, I know. I've covered a little bit of the transfer station stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the transfer stations are close to our schools. Like, they're not super far apart. Pawtucket's a small plot of land. So something that affects a neighborhood two blocks away, it will eventually make its way to every other part of the city.
Oh, no, because rats spread. I mean, they run out of food in one area, they start moving to other areas, right? And it's a really difficult thing. I know Providence had that issue for a while, but, you know, the bins we have now, the big blue and blackish bins we use, have really knocked down rats. I haven't seen a rat in my area in many, many years, although I still see them downtown occasionally. But, you know,
that's great.
Yeah.
We had slightly rocky rollout of like a new like automatic trash pickup.
Yeah.
I think things have gotten a little more steady there, but you know, a lot. I mean, even before I moved down here, and before I really saw how composting can work at a municipal level, I traveled to Halifax, Nova Scotia a few years ago and saw kind of their system of having compost, trash, and recycling all as just standard services.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's not a hard thing to do. It's just a way, it's a slightly different approach to a very common problem. And not saying everyone has to compost, but what if people who could decided that that was the route they were going to take?
Yeah, right. Cool. Excellent. All right. Well, I think that's good for our very first interview. I don't know if you have anything else you want to say or things I should have said or asked you and you're like, oh, I wish you had asked me this.
No, I mean, I could talk about anything for a very long time, but yeah. I do just want to like, I would be remiss if I didn't just give a shout out to the entire Pawtucket class of folks. We have a whole new team of legislators at the State House.
Right.
We have three new folks on the Pawtucket City Council. There's a lot of fresh energy and ideas, and it's been so important to me personally to have folks that I can call and talk to and just learn from. And I really think it is a tremendous group of folks that are representing Pawtucket at all levels of government right now. And I want to thank them ahead of time for what is going to be, I think, a tough couple years of service for all of us tackling these big challenges. But I know that the folks in Pawtucket who are serving have the skills, have the drive, and frankly, the really great ideas to help lead. And we've got some folks like Senator Cano on the education committee. I'm just really excited for the way Pawtucket can represent itself and try to like move this progressive change.
Nice. You know, as you started talking about the state legislators, it reminded me of something, and I wasn't going to ask this because it's a state issue, but it seems, and this is something that I've been thinking about, you're trying to build a new stadium, a soccer stadium in Pawtucket, and that stadium is going to draw people from all over the state to come there. And a lot of the people who come to that are going to be Latino, right? But there are some Latinos in the state who, because of their undocumented status, cannot get a driver's license. And so if they wanted to like go to a game coming up from Warwick, right, load the family into a car, let's go see a game, they put themselves at serious risk of being pulled over, losing their car, losing their job. You know, all sorts of things can happen. Even if it's not prioritized as a crime, it still becomes an issue they'd have to work with. It could cost hundreds of dollars. It could throw their whole family out of whack.
Yeah.
So it seems like this is something that the state legislators from the Pawtucket would say, you know, it's in the economic interest of Pawtucket to have driver's licenses for everybody. And that's just something, I mean, this is me just spitballing here at this point, because you just got this into my head again.
No, I completely agree. I was, you know, Pawtucket was one of this, I don't know if we were the only one, but we were a city that was like a census test city. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you covered that, but we,
yeah, I remember,
you
know, that.
It's,
Central Falls and I think you both were, Central Falls and Pawtucket were both part of that.
Exactly. And with that, I had kind of a similar thought process as you're having now, where I was like, oh gosh, okay, we have a lot. We're a majority minority town, period. We have thriving immigrant communities from Africa, from like Caribbean nations, from South America. We are a melting pot of Rhode Island here in Pawtucket and Central Falls. And at the bare minimum, all our citizens must be safe and must feel like they have freedom to live here, and not fear that going to a soccer game, going to the post office, you're going to be under that level of scrutiny. And I cannot, you know, I am a white German woman. Right. I cannot say that I have any idea as to what that type of fear or worry is like. And I think, I hope at both the state level, the federal level, there can be reform to keep everyone in this city safe, everyone in all of Rhode Island safe, and towards a path that will have these worries essentially become non-issues. Yeah, I just, I think is the bare minimum of what can be done now. And in the meantime, I also know just Rhode Islanders just like to drive. As a North Carolinian, I'm used to driving hours to anything useful, but up here in New England, you know, it's not that easy to do. And so I would hope that as things get going with the stadium, they will also be doing things like live streams to help folks who are fans that might not be able to get to Pawtucket for whatever reason, whether it's a socioeconomic issue. Not everyone can afford a car. Not everyone can afford a bus pass. Not everyone wants to take four buses to get from X to Y just for a game, you know? So how can fans still engage with this new team without always having to be physically present? Because it's not any public infrastructure, private infrastructure project this big is going to be complicated. And I'm not expecting that on day one, it's going to be like traffic is smooth, the buses are perfect. Like that's just, those are impossible dreams. So how can we also like gently get folks back into the fold of like coming to the city, enjoying the game, but also being able to enjoy it from a distance?
Cool. And that also opens up like the idea when you talk about making it safe for everybody, talks about how you police Pawtucket. And I know there's been a lot of pushback and there's a lot of issues with some of that. And that's something that the city council certainly does have a say in.
Yes.
Like establishing certain policies or laws or whatever it is. So what are your thoughts in that area?
I think between my kind of values of rethinking public safety models, alongside Councillor DeRosa's experience as a nonviolence activist,
right,
and also Councillor Rudd's experience as a Providence police officer, like just the three of us alone can have great brainstorms of how, like, and ideas that we would take to the administration and say, can we try this? Is there a pilot program that we can do to build trust, to rebuild trust with our public safety officials? Can we hold folks that are not doing their best work accountable in an easier fashion? Can we get community members who have had these lists of demands for a long time? Can we start ticking away at real change here? Because if the citizenry and those in charge of protecting the city cannot come to basic agreements on this stuff, that is like, that's a non-starter. We have to rebuild those relationships and trust and have more, I think, more transparency to solve these problems. And I think the current council is well suited to come up with these ideas and to work closely with the mayor's office, the administration, and the police department to try new things and to make change.
Cool. Yeah, I think there's definitely, I mean, one of the fundamental principles that I'm basing my work on is that people have a right to determine their own policing. That the community should say, this is the kind of policing we want. This is the presence we want. These are the crimes we're most worried about, whatever it is, right? That, you know, and if the community isn't doing that, if the communities are being policed, but do not have a sense of ownership of that policing, that's where a lot of these problems come from. And it might.
It's with any government role, you know, there was a saying when I was working in product management, because I was kind of, my job was to be a conduit for the market. So I would try to present data that would help the business thrive, but also help customers thrive. So it was always in this middle area. And the saying that we always used was, my opinion, however interesting, is irrelevant, because what's relevant is actually the people that are utilizing the services need to feel like those services are benefiting them. You know, it's, and if they don't, what is the recourse for doing that? In a public company, say you're a shareholder, you might call for the resignation of a CEO. You might call for a change of the leadership. You might remove your stake in the company by selling stock. There's a lot of different ways that you can actually make your voice heard. But when it comes to things like public safety, I think sometimes we face the challenge of like, well, who's right? And there's not like a who's right thing. It's a, can we actually have a talk? Can we actually admit and acknowledge that certain issues exist first? Because without that first acknowledgement, there's no problems to solve. We have to admit there's a problem. We have to also not just call it a blanket issue. We have to say, what are the specific problems? And then if it's a creative solution or just a basic solution to try to get both sides starting to like make more decisions together, that's best for everyone, because then the community is actively involved and knows who their safety officers are, trusts them. And it's a virtuous cycle of, oh, if I see a problem and I know that I have a good cop in my neighborhood, because maybe they went to Tolman, maybe they went to Shea, maybe they grew up here and all they wanted to be was a cop or a detective, that's great. Then they'll like, they will be here in the community and serving it in the best possible way. But if it's this constant, like, well, there's not an issue, or, you know, they're doing the best they can. Everyone's doing the best they can. Unfortunately, though, especially people like police, doctors, nurses, these folks that have the biggest responsibilities during these hardest times, they have the most responsibility to make change like within their own house. You know, I would almost like to see these police departments clean up their own houses, and because they know who in their office is great and they know where the problems are. And if they start to see themselves as empowered to make changes within their own world, that would be great, because I don't want to be a person that's constantly railing on it when I know that they probably won't listen to me. I've never been a cop. I've never been in this type of role. I've had roles where I work very closely with public safety. I was an RA in downtown Boston. You know, I tried to make sure that students stayed safe in the middle of a city. And I worked very closely with public safety officials, and we had a great relationship and no one got hurt. But that required the baseline level of trust to say, these officers have our best interests at heart, like right. Truly every citizen.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. I think we've exhausted it right now. I'm sure we'll have another conversation. Let's.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
Yeah, you were as well. Excellent. My daughter went to Emerson, by the way.
Oh, really? Yes. Oh, my gosh. There's so many Emerson people in Rhode Island. I will say, just before we close off the recording.
Yeah.
I truly believe it is like the best college in New England. I couldn't imagine having gone anywhere else. I looked at BU. I would never have gotten into an Ivy League school, so don't even get me started on that. But when I now with the Emerson crew that's working and tackling a ton of issues in the world, really, I think the value of a college that is focused primarily on communication in whatever form, that's great. You know, communication, media literacy, right. Creative arts, but all with the underpinning of like a strong liberal arts education. It's tremendous. I can't say enough good things about Emerson.
Very cool. Very cool. Excellent.